Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz, together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry. Yeah, I remember your name. We are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. I have to say this before we commence, and that is that the opinions that Brendan and I give during the course of this show and all the others are strictly our opinions. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty either individually or as a whole. And this is where I say good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I understand you're not feeling so well this morning, so do the best you can this morning.
I've got an upset stomach.
Okay, it's a beautiful.
The worst thing about that is that I when I have an upset stomach, I can't have my coffee, you know. And so I'm extremely grumpy this morning. So I hope you're ready.
As we say in Yiddish, Manish Tana Chalayla Chazdeh, which means why should this day be different from all other days? Okay, so. Okay, so you and your lack of coffee. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
and grumpiness.
So I'm sorry you're not feeling well.
Yeah, it's all right.
You get this credit for being this easygoing professor who's friendly to everybody and has this very calm demeanor. Okay, it's not quite that way with me. I don't understand. Okay.
It's called interaction.
I really don't know what it is, but I can tell you, and I want everybody who's listening to know, okay, that Brendan has his grumpy side, okay?
Yeah,
and if you
yeah.
push the right button, you can actually get him angry, okay? So, okay, and somehow or another, I have the ability to do that. I don't understand, okay?
That's because you're a contrarian, that's why.
That's true. That is very true. Yeah. And one of these days we'll tell the story how I literally purposely got Brendan so worked up that he just could not understand what I was saying or why I was saying it. Okay.
Yeah.
At the end, he finally figured out, you're just saying that, aren't you? And I said, yes. Yeah. So we'll talk. It was several years ago, but it kind of set the tone. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that we work. Okay. We start out the show with two segments, one for me and one for Brendan. And what do we really think? And for today, in a very calm way, in a kind of a happy way, I'm going to say a few things and then I will explain them all to you as we discuss things later today. Okay? I'll mansplain it to you. Simply put, I want to say the following, and it's important. For all of the criticism that the January 6th committee absorbed and endured for a number of months by people who thought they were moving too slow, who thought they weren't doing their job, that they weren't being tough enough on witnesses and they weren't getting anywhere, over the last couple of weeks, and in particular the past week, and even as late as yesterday, even more so, we have learned that this committee is doing everything we could possibly want them to do. They have interviewed over 300 voluntary witnesses. They have obtained information from people who were in the White House, who either cannot afford to fight it or don't want to fight subpoenas, so they voluntarily appear. They have obtained thousands, tens of thousands of documents, memos, and things that automatically are retained within the federal system that have laid things out. They've obtained text messages. They are aware of their own colleagues, who were deeply involved in this conspiracy. And it was a conspiracy, and we'll talk later how Peter Navarro has given it all away to Rolling Stone. Don't know why he doesn't want to testify, But he'll talk to Rolling Stone. And we'll talk about all of these people very shortly, all of the heads of the snake. It is very apparent that they know precisely what happened. They know precisely how it happened, why it happened, who was involved. We still know that somebody who was in the war room was taking pictures, and we have to believe was giving away all the information of the conversations to take place, and probably, don't know this for a fact, probably overheard conversations on a speakerphone with the then, you know, the former guy. From now on, I'm not going to use his name. He's just the former guy. I am immensely proud of the work that they are doing, and they are hardly done. And sometime in the next few months, they're going to start holding live, maybe even prime time, hearings where you will be able to watch and everybody will be able to watch and the people being named will be able to watch and all of the guilty people will be able to watch all of the evidence that they have accumulated. I think, honestly, someone commented, and I happen to agree with this. If anybody wants to point to the biggest mistake that McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, made, the guy who wants to be Speaker and never will be, even if the Republicans take the House, the biggest mistake he made was pulling all of the Republicans off of this committee. He left them with no one to stand up to the people that were there. He left out the most important thing. He has no idea what they know. He has no idea what they're doing. He has no way to stop what they're doing because the only two Republicans are doing exactly what they should be doing and exactly what the Democrats should be doing. Yes, things are leaking out, but they are not speculating. They are talking only when they know they have it, and they've got it. They're talking like they have it. They have it against all of them, including the former guy. I think the American, this committee will go down in American history with the Watergate Committee, saving our democracy, holding presidents accountable for the crimes that they commit. And there's a whole lot more we're going to talk about today. But the key is this. This committee is doing its job. It's doing it well, and it will be the downfall of the Republican Party. And that's what I think.
Sure. I sure hope that's the case. I mean, it's the comparison to the Watergate committee is an apt one, except that Watergate looks like, what, child's play compared to what happened here.
A misdemeanor.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Right. You know, okay. You know, a cover-up of a break-in, you know, come on, who cares? You know, when you're talking about comparing that to sedition, insurrection, right, an outright attempt to establish authoritarian rule here in the United States. You know, that kind of outranks whatever crimes Nixon committed. Yeah, there's plenty to talk about with regard to that. I've got, you know, as far as what I think this morning, I've been struggling with, I've got a couple of frivolous things that I want to talk about, and then I've got some serious things I want to talk about. So I'll start with the serious. What I really think is that Chuck Schumer is right, and I'll explain what I'm talking about here. There quite famously now has been some hesitation on the part of many Democrats to revisit the issue of the filibuster and perhaps change the rules of the Senate. To alter the filibuster when it comes to, in particular, voting rights legislation. Chuck Schumer yesterday sent a letter to Democrats, which, of course, he knew was going to get to the media. And it was very well done and very well thought out. And what he, when we talk about the Constitution, I think it's important to focus in on one of the things that, that Schumer pointed out in his letter. The framers of the Constitution, when they were debating the Constitution in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention, took up many different issues and looked at many different ways they could, might structure the Republic. And one of the things that they debated was, you know, when, under what circumstances should there be a requirement of a legislative supermajority to do something. And they discussed this, and there are notes about it. They concluded, for example, that it should require a supermajority of the Senate to ratify a treaty. That getting the United States right in a situation where we have international obligations is sufficiently important that it, a mere majority of senators would not suffice to endorse a treaty. They also agreed that it would require a supermajority to remove an officer of the United States from office. So these issues arose under the very limited circumstances under which the founders thought that a supermajority should be required. Clearly, they did not contemplate that it would require a supermajority in what is supposedly a democratic republic, right? One where the majority rules. They did not contemplate that you would need a supermajority in either house for mere routine legislation, just to legislate. So the filibuster really can be viewed as not just a-constitutional or extra-constitutional, right, outside the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution about a filibuster. But in a sense, it's anti-constitutional. And you add it to the list, you know, one of the reasons we are in such a mess and under the thumbs of such an ignorant polity is that there are structures, the filibuster is one of them, that that allow the political minority, in this case Trump Republicans, to entrench themselves in power. And I talk about this quite a bit, right? There's one problem, and this is this is something that you know that is the fault, if you will, of the founders is the structure of the Senate itself. Every state gets two senators, and that leads to gross overrepresentation of small, less populated, more rural states, which tend, of course, to be heavily Republican. So that's one. You've got the Electoral College, as we've now seen twice since 2000, upended the will of the majority of people, right? Once to the benefit of George W. Bush, and once to the benefit of Donald Trump, who will go down as history now as the only person ever to lose the popular vote twice, but nonetheless served 4 years as president. So that's another anti-democratic force. Another is
which, by the way, broke the record. Which, by the way, broke the record because there were three. There is at least seven who actually didn't win the popular vote that served a term, but then won
right.
the popular vote or were voted out in the second one. But
right.
he actually lost the popular vote twice and claimed he
yes.
still won.
Right. Right. Yeah, unlike George W. Bush, for example, who actually, he did win the popular vote very narrowly.
Oh,
right,
overwhelmingly.
Re-election.
Overwhelmingly the second time.
George W.?
Yeah. In the in his second vote, he won the popular vote overwhelmingly.
He won the popular vote, yeah. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the Electoral College can lead to undemocratic results. Partisan gerrymandering is the third thing I always talk about. The Supreme Court has refused to intervene in this practice of, and Republicans are very good at campaigning at local and state levels so that even though they typically lose the national popular vote they're in control of many state legislatures. So they get to draw the election districts, the election maps, and of course do so in a way to disadvantage minority voters and any voters who would tend to vote more liberal. And then we have to add to those three things the filibuster. The filibuster is a mechanism that unfortunately has come to be used as a blanket requirement of a supermajority to enact routine legislation. Democrats, although they control both the House and the Senate, cannot get anything done in the Senate as long as the filibuster is in place. So finally, we're seeing some movement. It's coming from Chuck Schumer. I've heard speculation, you know, that Schumer probably would not have said this if he hadn't already had some conversations with people like Joe Manchin. But hopefully we're going to see some movement here to change the rules of the filibuster rules when it comes to enacting voting rights legislation. Either outright get rid of the filibuster, just say you can't filibuster legislation like that, or at least reform the filibuster rules so that, for example, a senator would have to do a speaking filibuster. So that's, you know, more, I hope, good news. I don't know. You know, I can imagine Joe Manchin from West Virginia saying, well, I'm for voting rights, but I'm not for filibuster reform. I can see Kyrsten Sinema possibly saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to watch those two in particular. But from what we're hearing now, it sounds like Schumer's serious about this, and he's right about that. We should not have, in a democratic republic, we should not have a requirement of a supermajority to get through legislation that the vast majority of Americans want. It's ridiculous, and it has to stop. So that's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I happen to agree with you. I will tell you that the key will be this. If the legislation for Voting Rights Act is as close to the proposed Manchin bill as it can be, then it's hard for Manchin to explain why he would not do what was necessary to get his own bill through.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've said many times, I do not believe that Kyrsten Sinema is a profile in courage. I do not believe that she has the courage to be the one senator who stops a piece of legislation like this. I just don't think she has, you know, the cojones, obviously. But I just don't think that she can do it. She hides behind Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin uses her when he needs to get off of his own problem. But without Joe Manchin's full and complete support for what she does, she's really not going to do that. She's already feeling the heat back home in Arizona. Representative Gallego has already announced that he is going to run in a primary against her. So she is not going to win the Democratic primary. And she's not going to win as an independent. And Republicans have their own people. They don't need her. So her career in politics and her career in the United States Senate could be just a single term if she doesn't turn things around and start acting like the Democrat that she's always said she is. So we'll see what happens there.
Mm-hmm.
And what I said was a lot of things were happening that we would talk about in regards to the committee. I'll get to the committee in a minute. Something happened outside of the committee that was published last night and early this morning. I am not an avid reader of Rolling Stone. But in this particular case, I've taken part of my morning to read an article from Rolling Stone. This article is an interview with Peter Navarro, who was the director of trade and manufacturing in the Trump administration, who believes that he was truly the brains of the administration in every aspect of what it did. This is a guy who really wasn't a politician and really wasn't any of all of that, but he played it on TV, just like Trump, so he felt he could do this. And he stuck his nose into just about everything. And in this particular case, he stuck his nose into the election issues. And he wrote a memo, and the memo elucidated what he referred to as the Green Bay Packers sweep plan, named after the football team. And it's great play, the Packers sweep. And it was his plan, as he put it in his memo, to overthrow the election. Now, to him, it was not overthrowing the election. He still maintains that Trump won the election, that there was a great deal of fraud, and that all he was trying to do was expose the fraud. And so, therefore, he wasn't, as when he was asked specifically whether he was planning a coup, he said, "We didn't commit a coup, the Democrats did." Mm-hmm. Now, that's what he says. But this was his plan, and it's much as we have talked about on this show. He and Steve Bannon came up with a plan. They called it the Packer Sweep Plan. The idea was to enlist all of the Republican congressmen, congresspeople, to gum up the works in the Electoral College vote by objecting to every single certification. And with each one, it's a four-hour break. Now imagine if they do it with 10 states or 15 states. That's enough, according to his plan, to exceed the time limit of January 6th for the certification and to throw the election into the House of Representatives. Now, this is not a unique plan. We've talked about it before. But two things. By early January, the plan was starting. It had come together. Trump campaign manager Bill Stepien was involved. Deputy manager by the last name of Clark, Jared Kushner, were all involved in all of this, together with Giuliani and another guy by the name of Bernie Kerik, who was with the campaign. The whole concept was twofold, to provide a public forum where grievances that they felt they had regarding fraud and election could be aired 24 hours a day with televised hearings to the American public and bypass what they thought was the biased media coverage. And then second, to use that to interfere with the certification. The end game was either to get Pence to delay the certification or send it to what they called overtime. You didn't do it when you were supposed to do it. You lost your chance. Nobody got 270 votes. Therefore, it goes into the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. Where it failed, according to him, was the insurrection. That was not part of the plan. At least not part of his plan. And that provided Pence, McConnell, McCarthy, Pelosi, and Schumer an excuse to abort the Green Bay sweep plan and certify and get rid of it and certify the election. He doesn't know whether McConnell and McCarthy were read into the plan, but he believes that they were. It started flawlessly when Gosar and Cruz, who were the leaders in Congress of this plan, they were read into it. They were fully on board with it. I mean, this comes from Navarro. I'm not making this stuff up. And their job was to create, because all they needed was one congressman and one senator, and that's all they needed to have an objection. He doesn't know how read in others were, but Cruz and Gosar were the two that were supposed to lead the charge in Congress. Cruz is and has been and always will be a traitor to the Constitution and an authoritarian. The one thing that he won't do, Navarro won't do, is hand up Trump, at least not completely. He says he never read Trump into the plan. But he knows that somebody must have, because he had conversations with Trump who clearly indicated that he knew of the plan. Where Navarro was left out was Bannon and Stone and others who were promoting a violent insurrection to supplement the Green Bay Packers sweep.
Mm-hmm.
He believes, although he won't say it, that Bannon is the one that read the president in. I think it was Meadows, but he says it was Bannon who read, basically won't say it, but implicates Bannon in reading Trump into the plan. He uses this as an excuse why Trump could not have been part of the insurrection, because he knew what the plan was supposed to be and would never have done anything to interfere with the plan. But you have to understand, Trump can't help himself. He thinks everything he does is an assistance to what he wants to accomplish. This is what started it all. And he brags about it to Rolling Stone. This hurts Trump. By just saying that Trump knew about this plan to avoid certification of the election, like that's a natural thing to do. It's a marvelous interview. It's a marvelous article. I recommend it to anybody who wants to read it. All you have to do is Google Navarro interview with Rolling Stone. And it is just incredible. He gives the interview to a guy named Tim Dickinson, who does not let Navarro off the hook, but lets him talk. You have to read this. And this is just the first niche in what's going on now. What's really going on is that all of the heads of the snake are starting to bite each other. Navarro dumps on other people like Gosar and Cruz and indicates other people were involved with Trump without saying, I don't know who told Trump, but I think Trump knew, at least from my conversation. We have Roger Stone, who is now blaming the entire insurrection on Steve Bannon, and has said so publicly on one of those alternate Twitter type of sites. I'm not sure if it was Telegram or one of the others. Alex Jones, now saying he's getting the goods on Trump and he's going to expose him in regards to vaccination. So he's going after Trump on vaccination. And he's done the same thing. They're all going after each other, and they're going after each other for one reason and one reason only. Well, really two reasons, but the major reason is money. The money is drying up. They can't get the money because they're not on Twitter. So they go to alternate sites, and they try to avoid being on the same site with the other person. They're dividing up their audience. Less money for each of them, less money overall. What's her name? The former lawyer for Trump, who stood next to Giuliani.
Yeah, Sidney Powell.
I forgot her name. Yeah, Sidney Powell. She's now doing this and trying to raise money on a site and blaming other people. Giuliani's trying to raise money on a fifth or sixth site and blaming other people. Trump's blaming everybody. He's lost his audience. He and Bill O'Reilly are drawing about as many people to their little talks as the Marlins draw per game in Miami, and that's 4,000. In big arenas. Trump's shine is off. They're ready to go after him. And the last thing that's really hurting them is that QAnon is falling apart. People are so disillusioned with QAnon because nothing they say happens. Nothing they allege are going to occur occurs. Nothing ever is proven of anything that they're in their conspiracies, and people are walking away from them too. They've had enough. This is what we hope and pray for when we start dealing with fringe people. It's starting to fall apart. And it really started to rush when former General Kellogg gave sworn testimony, because he was with Trump on the day of the insurrection. He's the guy on the inside who saw it all. He's the firsthand knowledge. And he was a Trump guy. But he was a general first and a constitutionalist first. It's all falling apart. Finally. It's all being exposed for what it is, a bunch of grifters. And by the way, just so everybody knows, the leaders of the Third Reich were nothing but grifters. They were in it for the money. They were in it for the riches. That's what it was. They didn't care about the country. Certainly they didn't care about the Jews, but I mean, they didn't care about the country. They just wanted to make money. Everything revolved around making money. Well, that's the way it is for these guys. Bannon cheats people. Stone cheats people. It's all about the money, and they're all being shown for what they are. And if they can break that part of the party apart and disillusion them, the Republicans will never win election again as long as I live. That's what we're seeing right now. And we come back to McCarthy's biggest mistake. So that's stuff that's going on. I don't know if you guys have any comment on any of that. So,
yeah, that's
sounds like an epitaph. Sounds like an epitaph. We're just about ready to go in and pray.
Yeah, we hope.
You know what? It's time to say you're safe for them.
That's you talk about QAnon. The types of conspiracy theories that QAnon espouses. I was thinking earlier today, you know, it's important to distinguish between a theory about a conspiracy and a conspiracy theory, right? I mean, because there are actual conspiracies like the one that you've been discussing, right? There you have a factual predicate for finding that there was an agreement among two or more people to do something that was unlawful. So that's a conspiracy. And you might develop a theory about, right, what the aims of the conspiracy, the makeup of the conspiracy, whatever. That's different from a conspiracy theory. A conspiracy theory, when we talk about that, is a mental state of mind that inclines one toward wild and fanciful thinking. And one just has to wonder. And I often say, but sometimes I think we need to bring in some psychologists into this conversation. I was looking this morning. I was on a social media platform. I saw a link. Somebody linked to a USA Today fact check, and it goes like this: there was a claim floating around Twitter and Facebook that apparently generated what the USA Today characterizes as thousands and thousands of interactions, claiming that President Biden and the First Lady had staged a visit to a children's hospital on Christmas Eve. This was the conspiracy theory that was floating around the right wing on social media. And the basis for this conspiracy theory was that in the Reuters video that showed the President and First Lady at this visit, they circled in red. There was a sign behind Joe Biden that said Seacrest Studios. So the theory goes, and this the person who started this said, you know, everything Biden does is fake. It's all a lie. And here you can see he didn't actually visit a children's hospital because it says Seacrest Studios behind him. So this was a set, right? They were on a set. and made it look like a children's hospital. And again, right. thousands and thousands of people engaged with this and interacted with it and believed it. And I'm reading this thinking, you know, to credit a conspiracy theory at all, it should at least make some sense. Why? You ask yourself the question, why? Why would Joe Biden and Jill Biden stage a visit to a children's hospital? Why would they do that? It makes no sense. I thought the same thing about, you know, when Republicans, and this was a wildly popular conspiracy theory among Republicans during the Hillary Clinton days, was that she ordered a stand down, right, that led to the slaughter of Americans in Benghazi.
Right.
And I was, why would she do that? It makes no sense. Why would she want a U.S. ambassador killed on her watch? Again, you know, Joe Biden didn't actually go to a children's hospital. He has this thing called a motorcade. He can go wherever he wants, whenever he wants.
Exactly.
He has a helicopter, right? I, as you can tell, I mean, I get a little exercised about this because I don't understand this mindset, but it is sweeping right through millions of households, and it's again, you know, I sound like a broken record. You know, we say we're talking about the Constitution, and I am, because the existence of our constitutional republic depends on a body politic, right, a population that is sane, rational, and at least minimally informed. And we are
and the worst part, and I agree with that, and the worst part about it is that even in the 1800s, even in the what we consider the Wild West, there were newspapers. People actually read the newspaper, and those that couldn't read had people read it to them. They actually wanted to hear what was going on. They wanted to make their own decisions. They were wildly independent in that context. Not independent that they defied the decision, but that they wanted to be part of the decision. They wanted to hear what was going on and make a choice. People today don't want to hear and make a choice. They will just want to hear what somebody tells them the choice should be. Unquestioned loyalty, unquestioned following, Pied Piper-ish kind of thought process. Play your flute and they will follow. And that's really the problem here. And that is the Constitution. There's a reason why the First Amendment says freedom of the press. The first of the first is freedom of the press. Because even our founders knew the value of a free press, the information that it purveys to other people. We've lost that. We've lost the ability, some people have lost it over years, lose the ability to read. They knew how to read. They just don't use it. It's like any other talent. You lose it. Or it's just too difficult. I don't want to do that. I just want someone to tell me. That's where it's lost. And so when we do this show and we talk about some of this stuff, everybody, you can scream, you're only talking politics. Well, yeah, but the politics we're talking about is saving the Constitution, saving the country as we know it today. Not the vision of those who would toss it, who would burn it, and toss away everything because they want to keep their gun. Or they just don't want to take the time and trouble to go vote. They want someone to do it for them. That's the problem. And that's where the Constitution and the things that we talk about is important. The the separation of powers that we talk about, the ability to hold a president, okay, responsible for the things that that president does. And if he does something criminal, then he must be held accountable. Congress has to have the power to do what the founders wanted it to do. Oversight. And the Senate has to do what it was supposed to do. Vote. Not debate voting, vote.
Right.
And the court, the downfall of the Supreme Court started in December of 2000. I blame Rehnquist. I blame Scalia. I blame all of those conservative Republican appointees who decided that George Bush should be president of the United States, so stop counting the votes. I want you to think about how the country is different because they did that. Instead of Bush, we ended up with Gore. I mean, instead of Gore, we ended up with Bush. And because of the politicalization, the understanding that the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter who will be president of the United States, not the people, not the electors, we have politicized that body to the extent that it has the lowest rating of – only Congress is lower than they are. As the people who claim they're not political hacks but are political hacks go about their political hacking. That's what we're talking about. Our institutions that hold this country together are born out of the Constitution. And if people would just take the time, if nothing else, to read the first three articles. Okay, you don't want to read the rest of it? I got you. There's important stuff in there. But at least read the first three articles and maybe the first 10 amendments. Make it the first 14. There were originally 12 that didn't, 13, and three of them did not get ratified.
Right. Okay.
Everybody thinks the Bill of Rights was 10. There were 13 articles in the Bill of Rights, and three of them didn't get ratified.
Yeah.
But...
No. Just on your point about the Supreme Court, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, your point on the Supreme Court is it's interesting. You know, when we talk about the possibility of reforming the court, that's obviously not going to happen, but when you talk about whether it should happen, one of the things to keep in mind is, I talked earlier about George W. Bush being elected without the popular vote, and then Donald Trump as well. Those two, between them, all right, so those two Republican presidents who lost the popular vote, at least the first time around for George W. Bush, appointed five justices. George W. Bush put Roberts and Alito on the court. Donald Trump, of course, put Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett on the court. So we have a Supreme Court to talk about, you know, the forces pushing against Democratic rule, majority rule. We have a Supreme Court that clearly now reflects the will of a political minority. And, you know, I add to that equation all the shenanigans that went on, right, with denying Merrick Garland a seat on the Supreme Court when Scalia died. And changing the rules, right, when it came to Amy Coney Barrett, right, putting her on the court despite such a short time remaining in Donald Trump's term. So you can add that to the list, right? The Senate, the structure of the
yep.
Senate, the Electoral College, gerrymandering, the filibuster, and the composition of the Supreme Court, right? All of them work against the popular will. So, boy, that's a lot to overcome.
Well, let me tell you, mark my words on this, and I may not be around for the completion of it, but over the next 35 years, Amy Coney Barrett is going to be the Ginsburg of the right. She is going to be that kind of ideologue. And she's going to stay that way. You know, I complained when the first seat came up for Trump that he was about to appoint a judge who used to serve on the Florida Supreme Court and is now on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, that he was going to appoint her. Okay? Strictly for political reasons and because of the political power of her husband, who gained his power through numerous Republican governors and a senator by the name of Rick Scott. I knew things about her that clearly indicated she just was not qualified to be a Supreme Court justice. It was strictly a political appointment. And fortunately, it wasn't her. It turned out to be Gorsuch, who I have my differences with, but I think to a degree he is at least intellectually honest. And I agree with what he concludes, but I think he's intellectually honest. I cannot say that for Kavanaugh, and I cannot say that for Coney Barrett. Coney Barrett reads her Bible and makes a decision. Now, the Constitution, she reads her Bible. And her husband is making more money than he ever imagined he could being married to a justice of the United States Supreme Court. Because who's the greatest lobbyist on the face of the earth right now? Her husband. Because he can say whatever he wants to say to his wife. I don't know that it happens, but I suspect it does. At least people are paying his law firm believing that it does. So these type of political shenanigans are the death of the Supreme Court. That is not to say that Franklin Delano Roosevelt put Douglas on the court because, you know, he was a good guy. He put him on there because he was known as an ultra-liberal. It is not the reason why, in response to Warren's death, that Berger was made, who was a political hack, was made Chief Justice. But at least surrounding these individual problems was a court of intellectually honest people. I don't think we have an intellectually honest court right now. And the idea that they're going to return us to the 1950s and Ozzie and Harriet are going to sleep in separate beds we're going to bring back what, you know, when I was a kid, what was called the unwed mother's homes that were run by the Catholic Church, or that, as Justice Barrett seemed to indicate in oral argument a few weeks ago, that if you don't want your child, just leave the hospital and leave the baby in the hospital. Really? And you don't think the police are going to come looking for you? Really? That's what you think you should do? You think that's the solution to the problem? So we just don't have an honest court. It's the first time I can honestly say I do not believe they're intellectually honest. They're not reaching decisions in accord with the law. They're making political decisions. And it all started when? December of 2000. That's when the court became a political body, not a legal body. Not an independent legal body, but part of a political structure. And that's unfortunate. And has to be remedied. But in my lifetime, it won't be.
Right.
So all of you lawyers or law students out there, remember this when your chance comes to make a change. there was one thing last week that we never got to. A 14-year-old, or what was killed as a result of a shot that was fired at a bad guy inside a department store. She was behind a wall where the police officers didn't know where she was. I got into a rather heated discussion with some people at a group that we went to, and I said some things that I regretted, and I have apologized for those things. However, I do not apologize for my position on this. I just labeled this "here we go again." I'm a pretty liberal guy, but I think, okay, and my experience as a defense attorney and a prosecutor and a judge is that I think people do not understand good police officers from bad ones. They think every time a police officer pulls their gun and fires it, it's a bad thing. And it's not. In this particular instance, the police officers had received a call, part of their call as they entered the building, that shots had been fired. So they had reason to believe that the bad guy they were seeking had a gun. What he really had was apparently a bicycle chain with a lock at the end of it, which, by the way, happens to be a weapon on the street that people use. The bigger the lock, the badder the weapon is. And he was banging it against things that made people think those were gunshots. Now we know that. Police officers didn't know it at the time. The police officers were aware that this person who may have a gun had assaulted at least three other women, and they actually walked by one that was unconscious on the floor trying to find this guy. And they found him on the second floor, and they could hear the screams of the woman he was beating at the time with the bicycle chain. They turned a corner down, and they looked to the right, and they looked down a row between some of the clothes back towards the wall, and they saw this guy. And they yelled, "Put the gun down," because they believed he had a gun. The guy turned as if he was going to start charging the police, and they fired their weapons, and they killed him. But one of those bullets went through him, struck the floor, and went through the wall where a mother and her 14-year-old daughter were hiding. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for that young lady. I'm sorry that she, and I don't mean to call her collateral damage, but in this particular instance, she was collateral damage. She was a 14-year-old. She did not deserve to die. Absolutely, positively, that's a bad thing that happened. But going after those police, that police officer, for firing his weapon to save one person, to protect himself and to kill a bad guy, without knowing that behind the wall, behind the guy, were two people, totally out of line of sight, couldn't possibly have known they were there, and charge him with something because someone died, is ridiculous. Absolutely absurd. And I know, and the person that I got into the argument with, that I said some things that I feel bad about, her former husband who died of cancer was a New York City police officer who she proudly says never pulled his weapon in the line of duty, and I think that's fabulous that he was able to be a good police officer without doing that. I think that she should be proud of that, and he should have been proud of that. But believe it or not, a large majority percentage of police officers never pull their weapons in the line of duty. And even those that draw them, an even smaller percentage actually fire their weapons towards people. And they are to be commended for their ability to police without using deadly force. But part of the argument was that police officers shoot first and explain it later. In this one, it is all on video. Everything they said, everything they did, everything that this other guy did, the bad guy did, is on closed circuit video. Chased a woman down an escalator and then beat her when they got to the bottom with his bicycle chain. No question the guy was nuts. I don't have a problem with the fact that he was just out of his mind, nuts. But it's all on video. There's nothing being withheld from anybody. It is all transparent. And I'm sorry, in this particular case, I back the police officer. He will have to live with the death of that girl. We all do. But he did nothing wrong. He did what he was trained to do. He did what he was supposed to do. I don't know how any of you feel about it.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it in the depth that you have. But certainly I have seen instances, yeah, where police are justified in shooting, and sounds like that may be one. What I, as you were talking, I of course it brings to mind the recent conviction. Another thing we haven't talked about, of the police officer who shot a young man, thinking she was using her taser.
Potter. Officer,
yeah.
Potter.
What did you make of that verdict?
You know, she kind of convicted herself on the stand because she admitted that she was negligent by pulling the wrong weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I think a thought process that she knew exactly what she was doing in the heat of the moment. I mean, I want all of you to stop doing Monday morning quarterbacking and start thinking about the fact that, first of all, stop blaming her for stopping the car. A trainee stopped the car. Stop blaming her for, once they found the warrant, wanting to take him into custody. That's what they're supposed to do. Stop blaming her for the young man's attempt to escape by fighting her and not allowing the cuffs to be put on and jumping in the car and putting it in gear. Did she make any response in response? Did she make a mistake in responding the way she did by accidentally pulling her gun? Yes, she made a mistake. And there is a price to pay for that. But a mandatory 15 years for that? There are people who commit murder, real murder, who get less time than that. Something wrong with the system. I'm not arguing the verdict. I wasn't on the jury. I didn't hear it all. It was impossible for me to hear it all. And I have learned a long time ago to never question a jury verdict. Never. Somehow they always seem to get to the issue and they always seem to get it right. But in this particular case, I think that the penalty is far too great. And the claims of murder by people like Ben Crump, who's just out for a buck, or $1 million, one or the other, is just absurd. I just think it's wrong. But no, she convicted herself. The verdict was not wrong.
Yeah.
That's,
well,
yeah,
gentlemen, on
that
note, we should say goodbye.
Okay. It's 11 o'clock. It's time for you to leave. You have a big show coming up. I read the synopsis. You got a big show coming up.
Yeah, Absolutely. We're going to be speaking to the former California Senate Majority Leader, Gloria Romero. And she wrote a book, which is going to be unbelievable, just not that likable. Should be fascinating. I'll clue you in next week.
All right.
Okay. I may listen to it later. Have a wonderful week.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Take care.
Bye, everyone.
Talk to you later, Ben.
All the best. Stay healthy, guys.
Okay. Talk to you later, Brendan.
Okay.
Bye.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Okay, let's bring in, whoops, oh, I think I made a mistake there, and I accidentally disconnected our caller, Ms. Romero, so hopefully she'll call us right back, and so hopefully she will, and then we'll see what happened there. Anyway, so just so you know, we're going to be speaking to, oh, there she is, forgive me, I have to apologize. Bear with me a moment. Hello, Ms. Romero. My mistake. I accidentally disconnected you as I was disconnecting the two gentlemen that were on before you. How are you? And good morning.
Good morning. Happy New Year. It's great to be with you.
Happy New Year to you. All the best. Well, I'm blown away by the issues that you bring up, which is really phenomenal. And we don't speak about the disparities of how we raise our young women into adulthood, and that's one of the big issues. How were you able to, I guess, go beyond the way you may have been raised, or maybe you were raised in a way that gave you confidence in speaking your mind and being secure with what you had to say and how you had to say it? What made your life different? What changed you?
Well, I think I was really like probably most other girls in this country, young Latina girls as well.
Mm-hmm.
I very much saw that girls were supposed to be a bit subservient, a bit quiet. But I think really what transformed me was access to education. And education, that's why I've been such a champion on providing high-quality schools as a civil rights issue, especially for
mm-hmm.
girls, because it makes a tremendous difference in our lives. So I really credit being able to break through many of the sort of the expectations that girls are to be sugar and spice and everything nice and quiet, seen but not heard, a bit subservient. I would say that's really it. And then, of course, too, I mean, there were people in my life. You know, I did see some female teachers who were very encouraging. My mother, although she had a very low level of education, I saw that she really cared for her family and her children and carried herself with dignity. And I think those are important for young girls, understanding that we matter and we should use our voices to assert that.
Well, I guess I was very lucky because my mother, I guess my mother left the country where she was born at a very young age. She met my father, who also left the country where he was born, and they met another country, and they got married. And dad was always a very strong individual, but so was mom. Maybe it was just the concept of survival, and they did get an education. And I never really thought that, I think there was like a sense of a woman ran the home and the husband ran earning a living. And is that part of the disparity? But at the end of the day, I think women run the household, and they have tremendous power in the infrastructure, and yet somehow it doesn't go beyond the household. It doesn't go into the workforce. And why is that?
That was very much the traditional home in which I was raised. The two-parent home. My father worked. He worked the railroads. He worked night shifts, graveyard shifts, so he was often gone. And my mother, as you said, really ran the household and was very instrumental with all of us. However, if we look at today's statistics, we do find that much of that traditional nuclear family structure and even extended family, because we had grandma mm-hmm. who lived with us as well mm-hmm. and was very
Absolutely.
Important, like this woman of, you know, who she was just, she spoke no word of English, but we knew she exerted a great deal of power in the household. But today right. we find, you know, 50% of marriages end in divorce. And so I do think that a new generation of children being raised maybe with one parent, maybe those who are lucky who find an amicable divorce and have access to both, I do think there's something very important about having, especially for young boys, especially African-American boys, you know, with a fatherless home. I think that is very important in terms of some of the loss that we find for many of these young men. So it is a different situation today. And with single heads of households, we do find some of the challenges where especially women, they say men become single and women become single mothers. So women do find yeah. oftentimes that they become not only the backbone of the family, the economic provider, but also disciplinarian, and then having to become the loving and caring, nurturing mother as well. So the family structures are very important in what we see.
Well, did our society, because I tend to believe they wanted to do the right thing and to assist people who were financially destitute or not having an easy way, the jobs weren't available for them, but the welfare system, didn't that also undermine women's capacity to run the household and also kept men at distance from the family, and yet it just seemed to destroy our complete family structure, and we haven't corrected that yet.
Right, I agree with you on that point. I think, you know, there have been good intentions in trying to provide a safety net, you know, in terms of mm-hmm. shelter and food and some health care as well. But to some extent, it has become a system that can be gamed and is in need of change and reform, because it, like, for example, in California, where I reside, we find a
right.
lot of issues where, you know, we find that tapping into the government, you know, welfare system, as it's called, can also make one very dependent. Oftentimes mm-hmm. critics of the system say that especially women become married to the government, and there are monetary incentives to, for example, not marry or to have separate households where father is not present. So while I believe in a strong safety net that's important for families going through separation and economic issues, there also are the negative connotations and implications and outcomes that we do have to have the courage to address meaningfully, so that a safety network can be that, but it should not substitute a marriage or a family.
Well, it's interesting. I read a lot of international press, and something came out of the French press. Evidently, six French police officers are going to face disciplinary hearings today, accused of administrating failings in the gruesome case of a woman who was killed by her husband last May. And it turns out that she's one of 113 femicides that happened in France in 2021. And that seems to be also happening here in the United States. Is everyone going through this process of disrespecting women?
Well, I think what you describe, and I'm glad you used the term femicide, because I think it really is a word and a description that we should look at, whereby both men and women are, of course, can become victims of murder. But oftentimes
yes.
when it's a female homicide, a murder, there may be different intent. And as I describe in my book, Just Not That Likeable, I go into a whole description of how women are depicted in the media, some of the stereotyping involved. When we
right.
take a look at assault, sexual assault, for example, or domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
these are very much violent crimes that are directed to an individual because of their sex, because of who they are. And so when we take a look at violent crime that's occurring against women, I would say that a lot of the underlying pinnings are based on misogyny, you know, the beating, the assault, the sort of the
right.
implication that a woman is weak and therefore she can be and she should be handled and treated.
You know, I listen to your tone, your tonality and your assertiveness. You seem to be very, very assured of what you believe in, how you arrived at it. Does that put off a lot of men? Are they that insecure that they can't handle a position that a woman takes? And why is that?
Absolutely. And that really became the impetus for the book, Just Not That Likeable, The Price That All Women Pay for Gender Bias. For example, let's stop and think about it. Right now, and regardless of what one thinks about them politically, you know, it doesn't matter
yeah.
if you agree with their politics or not, but think about some of the women who have run for higher office just in the last year or two. Go ahead and take a look at Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar.
Right.
I mean, many women in the political arena are castigated for being, quote unquote, too strong, too nasty, too abrasive, too pushy. On the other hand, we could have men, for example, let's say Bernie Sanders, who ran, who usually was yelling, but became a very likable, a very, very affable. We sort of tolerated it. We expected it. It was okay for him, but not for her. As I point out in the book, many women in careers, especially as we allegedly break the glass ceiling and we move forward into executive suites and offices, still
mm-hmm.
face that same a double bind, a double standard, where on one hand we're supposed to be leaders and be strong and be commanding and lead, but on the other hand, it defies still that stereotype that we're supposed to be nurturing and likable and soft. And so when we laugh, it's called cackling, like a witch. It's not laughter. We cackle, men laugh. And so, yes,
really?
I have faced that in my experience.
Well, that's mind-boggling. You know, it's funny. There were a lot of assertions against the former governor, Cuomo, who had to step down. And the person that was elevated to become the new governor in New York State was Kathy Hochul. I found her a breath of fresh air. I found her assertive, forceful, knowledgeable, compassionate. She incorporated every female and male, demeanor. And I was astounded that she could be hidden because I guess if the former governor recognized who she really was, she eclipsed him in so many different ways. And she was able to reach out to people in a manner that he never had the capacity to do. And I come from a country where women rule. You know, like I come from Israel, and we listen to women. You know, maybe chauvinistic to some extent, and I don't deny that that is not always the case. But when it comes to the military, the men are on the front, but they listen and take orders from the women. They run the whole
right.
thing from top to bottom, and
right.
there is no issue.
And we've seen tremendous changes, and we've seen more women gaining power. But if we look at it overall, we find the one or the two, and historically around the world, whether it's Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi,
yeah.
Angela Merkel, you know, they have risen to the top, but also there were prices that were paid in terms of how they personally were evaluated, including Golda Meir, how she was characterized and described.
Oh, yes.
But if we fast forward to the United States, we've never had a woman president. We now have a female vice president who was chosen by a male. If we take a look at the disparities in Congress, if we take a look at the number of governorships across the country, they are few and far between, even women senators. I take a look quite a bit at the corporate America, where we take a look at where power is, and we find that only 4% of Fortune 500 chief executive officers are women.
Mm-hmm.
I find out, ironically, there are more men named John who are running S&P 1500 companies than there are women of any name. So when we take a look at women who have assumed and gotten into positions of power, it's a struggle to get there, to beat down the door, to break the glass ceiling. I talk about you have to traverse a labyrinth that's hard to understand, but then the challenge
yes.
is staying there. And that's where you begin to find many of the conflicts that come up, where we're told that it's a mismatch, that women are expected to lead, but when women do lead, then there is the castigating that goes on in terms of personality, or being told, well, we want you to be strong, but you're abrasive. You're pushy. Whereas men are expected to be more tender leadership, women are still expected and rewarded for being indirect rather than directly taking on issues. I find it fascinating to read biographies of women executives like Carly Fiorina, for example,
who also
ran for the presidency.
Correct.
And she talks about how people focused on how she looked rather than how she led a company. So these are the kinds of issues that women face, and that I point out are reasons why there is such a disparity in terms of women getting into those highest positions of power. And it all starts, as you pointed out earlier, it begins with early socialization, what we see in the media, in education, in our classrooms, even on the internet, games that are happening. We get socialized.
Unbelievable.
That roles are supposed
too.
To be sweet. Yes.
Yeah. How do we change that dynamic, and what is the rationale for changing it? Because I find that 51% of the population is being dismissed. Are men so insecure that they've been permitted to develop, and they've been nurtured a certain way. And why aren't we nurturing women to be more assertive, to be more self-assured, to be secure in who they are and how they look? Why are we trying to undermine them when we can't live without them, but we certainly can't, we shouldn't even think of controlling them? And why don't we talk about boys the same way? Oh, you're heavy, what? You don't have the right... Your beard is too thin, or who knows what. I mean, I don't know how. I never even think about these sort of things. I just accept people for who they are, and I look for what's good about them rather than what's negative about them.
Right.
We're not teaching them in school.
Well, and let me just say, too, in defense of men, it's not only the men. Women are culprits in this as well. You know, we talk about
the sisterhood. Oh, I know that they are.
Yeah. And the sisterhood isn't always there. And oftentimes women can be the worst critics of other women. When we take a look at men and – yeah, when we say – when men and women are asked, who would you rather work for, a male or a female boss, and that's the only uh-huh. information that's given, both men and women say, oh, I'd rather work for a man. And a lot of it has to do with that rejection of the notion that a woman should be strong, because if she is strong, she's defying the stereotype. So it's both men and women. But in terms of what we can do, I think, let me start at the back end. For women who are in the workplace right now, it's not lost on me that 42%, imagine that, almost half of women in this country indicate that they experience gender discrimination at work. So I think it's very important to start documenting this. We cannot just go into the women's room, you know, the ladies' room, and have the conversation, or go home and tell a friend. We've got to file the paperwork. And I talk about how there are choices that women need to make as to how to file, and depending upon the resources that are available to oneself. But if we don't document it, it gets lost. I think also, too, that in the workplace, that women, though, cannot just be the gender police themselves. It takes everyone to speak up. And we have to rethink how we do evaluation and training. I very much believe in doing training of staff regarding gender bias in the workplace and how it negatively affects women particularly. But then going back to education and schooling, you're absolutely right. We've got to take a look at how we socialize, even our language, how we speak, how we describe. There's a chapter in the book where I talk about Hollywood. Gina Davis, the actor who really – yeah, she's worked at USC to really highlight the depiction of women in the media. And that's something that we all see. So we see these stereotypes, where women are still supposed to – women can't get old. We can't get a wrinkle. Our hair can't go gray. We cannot gain weight. Otherwise, we are not forgiven. And so she talks about how as women age, women get erased from Hollywood in favor of the ever younger woman. And this sends a message then when women, career women, gain access to these, the highest levels of a corporation, still look through we are looked at through that lens of, but you're not young and pretty and quiet and you're supposed to just answer, not lead. So we have a lot to do at all ends.
You remind me of a time I ended up finding a woman extremely attractive. However, I think this was when I was in my mid-30s, and she had gray hair. And she one time said to me while we were dating, she said she didn't understand what I was attracted to with her, because she said that most men would never go out with a woman with gray hair because they don't see them. And I was like in shock. I said, where did that come from? Because her personality is what shined about her. And the color of her hair meant absolutely nothing. But she was astounded that anyone would look at her.
I didn't realize
all those things. I remember them now.
Right. And, there's been a lot of conversation about the reboot of Sex and the City, the new spinoff.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's interesting that some of the main stars are talking about, they're a little bit surprised at how much criticism, a lot of it coming from other women, about, oh, how do you look, or have you done this, or your hair is gray. And so, I'm not advocating for this series. I watch it because I used to like to watch Sex and the City. I think there was some really good humor. And so I like to watch it. But it was really interesting that right away the critique becomes, how do you look? How many wrinkles? Do you have Botox? Do you dye your hair? And so the plot and the storyline gets lost after all these years. What do you look like as mature women?
Uh-huh. How do we change this dynamic? How does it happen that we can change the dynamic? Who should be teaching us? And then going back to what you said before, documenting it. Why aren't women documenting all of this? And there are lawyers who are also women who probably have a greater understanding of the dynamics that undermine them. So why don't we do it? We have a legal system that should be able to facilitate all this documentation and then put an end to it, no? Or is that
right.
a long haul
in
too?
In the workplace, women oftentimes get scared because this is my job. This is my livelihood. I've got to provide for myself and my family, pay the mortgage, et cetera. So it can be, and many people are warned against just saying, just accept it or quietly go away. But I think we have to challenge that. We have to break those chains. And that's where I call upon, human resources and corporations to really begin to identify and out this information. So we've got to really document and file. But then going back to it, like I say, as parents, what are the expectations and stereotypes we have and we hold towards our female and male children? I was a psychologist by training, And I've reviewed much of the literature on how we socialize, how we raise our children. And it's not like we're doing anything nefarious. We're not trying to hurt our children. But we do, mm-hmm. you know, we are creatures of our society and culture. So we carry these stereotypes of how a boy and a girl are supposed to act. Toys we're supposed to play with, how we're supposed to dress, how we're supposed to speak. And so I think we have to really look at, do we provide for greater flexibility for our children to be children and not try to target them right away? You're a girl, so you must play with a Barbie, or you're a boy, so you must have, you know, action G.I. Joe. And so we talk a lot about how we start as parents. School play a very important role in reinforcing the expectations of how we think boys and girls should behave. Even things like video games, as I point out in the book, much of these, and it can surprise people when we take a look at the games, how are female characters depicted in much of the games?
Yes.
And people would be surprised to see some of these games and how girls are depicted. So it really is, you know, like they say, it takes a village. There's a lot to be done at all levels, but I think the most important thing is to be aware and cognizant. And this book is actually the first time that a book has been written from cover to cover about this entire topic. So it's having
it's
the language
absolutely
and
brilliant.
Discussing it.
Well, give me
I thank
one
you
second.
It
looks like I've been delinquent because somebody is calling, and probably it's for you, the question. So let's pull them in. Bear with me a moment.
All right.
And let me just say hello. Bear with me. Good morning. You're on the air. Do you have a question? But before you begin anything, would you just give us your first name?
Yes, my name is Josh. I'm from East Central Illinois.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for calling. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I was looking into the social dynamics and exactly what the lady was speaking on. The way that we, you know, we push boys to play with trucks and soldiers and all this stuff and girls to play with Barbies. I was wondering if that came from something we've known for a long time, like boys are more interested in objects and girls are more interested in faces, like people. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of it, though, is into the socialization that are we given that piques our interest so that we can have not be necessarily directed. This is the automatic path you go on, but allowing children to play. Because if we think about it, for example, and here's an example that I give, you know, with Barbie. There's the Ken doll, and then there's G.I. Joe. But the Ken doll is considered to be a girl toy, not a boy toy. And that's because Ken, who has a face also, just like G.I. Joe, but he has been manufactured and produced to basically become the love interest of Barbie. G.I. Joe, who also has a face, he has no relationship. I mean, really, we know nothing about G.I. Joe. Is he married? You know, does he have children? We just know he's there to save us. And so he is an action figure. And if you walk into a toy store, I used to love to go to Toys R Us before when they were shut down, but you can still find them at Target or Walmart or anywhere. G.I. Joe is located on the shelves that are more so considered to be the boys section of the toys. And Ken will never be found in the boys section. Ken is placed next to Barbie. So I think it still goes back to the question, what are the expectations and how are we channeled and socialized? And that's okay. I think it's great for girls to play with Barbies and Ken dolls and boys to play with G.I. Joes, but we shouldn't be restricted. If a girl wants to play with G.I. Joe, then I think more power to her. And if a boy wants to play with a Ken doll and a Barbie, I think that's great too. My only issue is let's be aware of how we channel rather than permitting our children to make some choices.
Yes, ma'am, I appreciate that.
Both of you, Josh, thank you for making the call. Forgive me for picking you up a little bit later than I should have. And Ms. Romero, hopefully you'll come back again. I don't think we've even scratched the surface on this issue, and you're so eloquent and so wonderful in the way you give expression to your concepts. I would be delinquent if I wouldn't invite you again. So hopefully you'll feel comfortable to do that again. And maybe, Josh, you'll be able to pull at that point, too.
Thank you so much. I look forward to returning to speak to you and your listeners.
Thanks very much. Thank you both, Josh, and thank you, Ms. Romero. A pleasure. So we'll pick up our next guest. Bear with me. And let me just make sure I don't disconnect him. And here we are. We're going to bring in Bob Marone. Good morning, Mr. Bob Marone. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you? I'm doing fine. You know, so far I'm surviving and, you know, keeping busy, and things are going well. Things are, shall we say, getting better. Things are looking up.
Well, that's good. So you're steering clear of the Omicron virus and staying healthy, and you've got a good mindset. That's very, very good.
Well,
is it the joy of the new year that brought you to this plateau?
No, just old-fashioned hard work and very frankly, just not giving up. For myself, as you know, I lost my business, although not forever. COVID hit me right between the eyes at my new radio station. And but what I've managed to do is between doing fill-in radio, planning the resurgence of Radio Westchester, doing work. I actually do I did contact tracing work, and I do vaccination work for the county, and I'm doing a labor of love, as you know. I've just begun a role doing public relations for Choice. So those things have helped me not just to get back up, but stay on my feet and plan the next phase of radio.
Mm-hmm.
It will very likely be very different than what I was doing.
Okay.
Very much so.
And so tell us about Choice. What is Choice about?
Okay. Choice is... And for those people, I know you have a Westchester audience for sure, among many others. Those who live in New Rochelle and White Plains and Peekskill probably already know. Choice is a what's called a peer nonprofit, and we get work getting the homeless people into programs, off the street, into housing. Help them work on what fundamentally is the basis for their homelessness. It could be going through a bad stretch in life. They need a job, but most of course, and importantly, they need housing. So we help get them into first perhaps a shelter, then a place to live. But we do target if they have an underlying issue, if they should have a drug issue, if they should have mental illness. We help get them into programs, and pretty much whatever might be the problem, basically. And we also work with mental illness, I would say, is the core of what we're trying to manage, to get the word out more successfully than it even has been, not hide what mental illness is, but actually help get the public more informed about it, help people who deal with mental illness get access to help, because the help is there. You know, there are programs.
Well, actually, I don't agree with you. I don't think the help is there. I think there's been a reluctance of society to look at the issues. We've got people who used to be in the military who suffer from PTSD, whether they suffered it while they were in the field of...
Okay. Allow me to correct myself, Hezzy. You're very right. The help is not there in the sense that people have set up organizations such as Choice to target it. What I'm saying is it's about advocacy. And I'm sure if my CEO was here with me, he'd be saying, Bob, remind them that it's about advocacy. For example, God forbid, Hezzy, if you were homeless but you were willing to work with us, we would drive you to our offices. The first thing we would do is help you get cleaned up and help you find a shelter immediately, because there's not housing right away. But we would sit you at a computer or work at that computer with you and get you your food stamps and get you your first steps towards getting housing. We would drive you to that first place. We would set up appointments with you and for you to get either into a mental health program, drug program, or whatever you need. We would work on getting you training, and we would really focus on this issue of mental health. And so that really is my point. We would advocate and use the programs that are out there. That someone, you mentioned PTSD, someone who's suffering from PTSD may not either have the will or the wherewithal to go. These programs are onerous, as you well know, to apply.
Well, I know, but if you're suffering from PTSD, it's not because of the war. It's because you're on the street and you don't have a place to live and you don't know where your next meal is coming from and you don't have a home to call your own. And people steal whatever you might have on you, and it's very insecure. Like, I was in shock. Like in Yonkers, for example, they say, oh, we got places to take care of people who are indigent and are suffering from this or the other. And I said, really? So how many places, how many facilities do you have open that you can take care of people? Oh, we're full. So I said, so you got nothing, but you talk a good game. I remember there was an investment in the South Bronx on Tremont Avenue. And what they did was they built a facility. They were basically one room only. So if you were, before you could leave the facility, you had to go see the concierge, and the concierge would give you your meds if you were taking meds, and they would make sure that they would take you to a place for training for a job, and they would do all those things to facilitate and reintegrate you into a society, and yet you had people there to give you the medication and so on and so forth. And we're not spending the time on this, and it's probably costing us more trying to contend with this population who are not being cared for, and I don't understand why. I just don't get it.
You're on the money. You know, I should be having you writing some speeches for me. That is the issue. Those are the issues. And where we come in, or what we're out there to do, is be the person that stands with you and says, you don't have a place in this home, we'll find a place in another home. Mm-hmm. What you're looking for, which we would totally endorse, is some sort of an institutional process that dealt with the problem that way. We couldn't agree more. What we do is we face that problem with them. And the people
is society's problem the fact that we're not funding operations like Choice? Do you have to raise money on your own in order to be able
society? Great question. We're wholly funded, at least at this point, by government, and that's my point. We're wholly funded by government grants that are created to address this, that most individuals and even other institutions, some do, they don't know how to access it. So we do know. We have very rigid, it's actually a big part of what Choice does, is trying to get this money and being sure we can get this money. And we have to follow, as you would imagine, very rigorous rules in how we treat our clients, what we do for them. But there is, again, there are not solutions. But there's money for housing. There's money for food stamps. There's money for education. But one of the things you said, I'd like to go back to it because it's one of those things that's almost thematic in this. There is, in our country, and I'm sure in others, but in our country, there's an aversion. Your reaction was right, spot on. There's an aversion to people that were homeless, like it's somehow their fault. There's this feeling, just keep them away from my storefront. Just keep them away from my kids. Just keep them away from me. I don't want to deal with it. And then as you said, the PTSD, if it started for some reason or just bad luck, it is either initiated or compounded by their homelessness. You know, these folks, and I say these folks because it was before I got involved, a huge car service shut down, and they went out and they bought a fleet of cars. And if you're homeless someplace and you wish to, you know, you have to agree. You don't have legal power to take any of your freedoms away. But if you agree to let us help you, we're driving out to where you are. We're putting you in the car, and we're taking you to wherever it is you have to show up to make these things happen. And we have everything from clothes to training to, and again, it's not simple. There's a lot of recidivism. Some people start and don't finish, but they've had an enormous, and I say they because I just joined them. I can't take any credit for it. I've been on their board, but the people where the rubber meets the road really care about these folks. And they will drive out to where they are, pick them up, take them in, and we have a fleet of computers where we can sit down, get you your Metro card, get you your food stamps, and if a particular shelter isn't open, we'll find a shelter, and then we work hard to get housing. And, of course, if there are the underlying issues again, we will make sure that the stigma of mental illness and homelessness doesn't keep you from getting the help that you need. And a lot of it's awareness. People are, you know, Hezzy, we've talked about you helped me write my book 10 years ago about what happened to me with mental illness. Now, when I was sick with depression, you couldn't tell your boss you had agitated depression. You just didn't do it. You know, I had to make up that, and it's still that way to a lesser extent, but it's still that way. People will look at you with a curled eyebrow if you say you were once homeless or you have mental illness. So we do all we can to take the stigma away from that. And as you know, I've been talking about it on the air for the 20 years I've been on the air. And I will take on all comers. I will go anywhere someone suffers from depression, the kind that I had, which I know more about. I mean, I'll go anywhere for anyone who has a mental illness problem. But if I know that my experience can help someone, there's no time of day that I wouldn't go there. It's that horrible. And I think what people who've never dealt with it, they really cannot appreciate the horror of it. And I imagine
that it would be difficult for anybody to even contemplate what it would be like if you don't have a home, if you don't get your medication, if you take drink in order to satisfy your body's craving for something, and where you're getting assaulted and beat up and hurt and maimed, and you have no place to go to defecate or take a piss, and being pushed from here to there, and even being recognized unless the cops want to bother you. And there's no place to sleep.
There's a question almost in what you said. Our CEO, very interesting guy. In fact, that's his name, Guy Fressenden. You know, I'm still just 3 or 4 weeks on the job now, and I'm trying to build a message, a consistent message. And the first thing he said to me during my interview of him in developing this message was, imagine the very worst day of your life. Fear, failure, no money, horror, the worst day of your life. These homeless people live that in a perpetual state.
Right.
And that really stayed with me. You obviously have a lot of compassion for these people, but a lot of people don't. And so what
Why?
Does,
What's
that's
the problem?
There.
They're just a human. We're not that far away from people who may be on the street sleeping on the pavement. I'm surprised, you know, especially nowadays, people don't have food. People are waiting in line at houses of worship to distribute food once a week or twice a week, and they go from place to place because there isn't enough food. Who knows if they can, if they're not in arrears in their rent. I see people literally lining up 50, 100 people long at churches that I never saw a soul go in and out of. It's amazing. I mean, these are different times.
Well, there's been, you know, we're getting into some of the causal issues of poverty as well here. And we have
That's usually
gap.
The cause of it. Maybe the mental illness comes first and the poverty is next, or it could be vice versa or both.
I mean, this has happened before in history, and it's led to revolutions.
But we're a lot wealthier today. What's the problem today? Maybe this couldn't have happened in the 1950s.
The upper segments of society are a lot more wealthy than they were in comparison to the lower levels of society in terms of income. And that income cap, which we just read about, is real. And a lot of people are getting left behind. And it's not an easy fix. We see the political state that the country's in. We've got blue-collar folks who have worked hard all their lives, and their income has been taken away by progress, by technology. We don't have the kinds of blue-collar jobs that we used to have. We still have construction, which is great living, police work, firefighter work. We don't have the factory jobs we used to have, and they've been replaced in number by service jobs. And when you look at the last 50 years in this country, where we've obliterated unions, in some cases for the good probably, but in most cases probably not, you know, they're reaping, that's one good thing. Those businesses and classes that have been getting by paying people $7 and $8 an hour, they're suffering greatly. They can't get people, and so maybe we'll see a change. But the political environment is very difficult to achieve that change right now, hasn't?
Might be the case. But you know, that's where we want it to be. I don't know why. It seems that we want to suffer as if they made a mistake in life. They may not have made a mistake in life.
Even if they did.
Sometimes circumstances. Yes, so what? Exactly. So what? So they did. But the system stinks. You know, like you want to make believe that you want to employ somebody and, you want to give them a job, you know, protecting a bank. Really? Give me a break, and you're paying them, what, $7 an hour? Or you want to give them, $10 an hour to work in New York at a fast food joint? You can't pay anything like that. Even if you work your 40 hours a week, it doesn't amount to anything. You know, it's crazy, this stuff.
You know,
I don't know what to tell you.
Well, there are some silver linings in this. There are things that repulse.
Nice.
I'll tell you what they are. The silver lining. You can't change anything until you frankly confront it and deal with it and accept it. And while policies that were originally well-intended have sort of backfired, particularly out west, where you see the homeless communities. I mean, I've been to Seattle and San Francisco in recent years. What's kind of different about it, and the status quo gets a little pinky in their eye, because here in New York, if you set up a tent in front of the Empire State Building, they'd clear you in a minute. But in Seattle, all their iconic buildings, the homeless are there too. In San Francisco, they're there too, and they're in the parks. Now, that is unsightly, and people complain about it every day. But ergo, the nice thing about it, if you will, not a nice thing, but a benefit is, people are finally saying what you said at the beginning of this call. My God, what's happened with this problem in this country? To a great extent, homelessness has always been here, but it wasn't in your face like this before. So maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
And some,
our society is failing.
Sometimes cynicism helps solve a problem. because cynically, people want the homeless off the street. Cynically, and also with good intention, some, or perhaps half, I don't know. Cynically, they want the homeless off the street. They don't want people mm-hmm. to get shot on the subway because they're out on unsupervised parole. They don't want the mentally ill roaming the streets who aren't getting help. They do want to deal with the opioid crisis. They do want to deal with suicide. And now when people are paroled, they do want them supervised in a more effective way. But what we do, and this isn't to say we have all the answers, but and this is coincidental. It wasn't set up for those cynical reasons. It was set up for the right reasons to address that pit, that rock you have in your shoe about this, to really help people. So I'm hopeful, as someone who's also a little practical, that as we now reach out and become well-known, and we're well-known in some cities in Westchester. We're well-known in New Rochelle, Yonkers now, Peekskill, and we're getting there. But we're not really a household name yet, and we should be. Everybody knows United Way. Everybody knows Volunteers of New York and so forth. But they're only now learning about choice. So I'm hopeful that even
How do you differentiate to the consumer who may not need your particular services you supply to people who are in need? How do they differentiate between United Way and, let's say, choice? Do they understand the differences?
United Way raises
I'm not
money.
Interested in United Way. I'm interested in choice. So what is
differentiates
you from other places?
And there are other smaller places that do. We advocate. God forbid, Hezzy. I'm sure you've been in a situation where a member of your family was sick, but they didn't have the wherewithal to deal with the insurance and the complexity of the doctors and so forth.
Right.
Well, we have legal people, caseworkers. We are the advocate who is standing there with you when you apply for these benefits, when you go to get mental health
services. You also teach them what benefits do exist that they may not even be aware of, and therefore they can also not even apply for.
Right. I mean, they're shocked when we hand them a Metro card. They're shocked when we are able to.
I didn't know you could get a free Metro card, but
You're entitled to these things if you're in that state. But they don't know how to do it. And well, we'll give them a Metro card that we'll have for them right away. But we will get them a Metro card and food stamps and so my point earlier on in this conversation was there are solutions there, but people don't know how to get at them. And we help them do that. And sometimes it's tough love.
Isn't the biggest issue that they have to have a place where they can live rather than on the street or the sidewalk?
Yes.
Because
underlying
what's the point of getting food stamps if you've got no place to eat it?
Precisely. I should have prefaced it with not necessarily in this order. But number one, and you should be doing this, is housing. The issues about housing, the issues about affordable housing. And it is very
So do you also advocate for affordable housing as a component of a particular community?
Yes,
and how does that go?
For affordable housing.
That
something
fly
that
in a community or are they averse?
I would be speaking, I would be ill-informed if I knew the process. I know that we do it. That's still on my to-do list to sit down with those people and find out how we do what we do. But yes, of course, we're advocates for the home, for housing. That's what we do. So, but I'll have more on
the week to come. It was very interesting because unfortunately, and when I look at the political discussions about affordable housing, there's a disconnect. For the need,
totally.
And then and then on the other side, how much of the housing would be set aside for an affordable tenant, someone that would qualify for an affordability, and the developer, and why there isn't, for example, one set up percentage-wise for the entire county. Maybe it should be one for the entire state. You know, in order to make it easy for one community to be able to match the needs of another community so that there isn't competition.
I could not agree more. And the problem, as you know very well, it does become political. There are the political realities. But we, in terms of the individual, we navigate those waters. So Section 8 is a big part of what we pursue for people who do dirt, or certainly don't have the means. And again, if they are mentally ill or totally broke or whatever the case may be, or all of the above, or drug addicted or PTSD or down on their luck, in every case, they qualify for the benefits. It's kind of funny.
So how do people find you? If they're in need, no matter the circumstances, they are where they are right now, how do they find Choice, or does Choice find them?
We do both. One of the reasons that I'm doing this job is to answer that first question. To go on, I'm still in the learning stage, and you're someone that I trust, so I'm on early with you.
Presumptuous of me to ask the question. Okay, well,
no, it's not presumptuous at all. No, it's not presumptuous at all, Hezzy. It is absolutely, you reached a point that, again, you're an interviewer. You do this for a living. We've reached the point, this is why I'm here. We do exist. Mm-hmm. We have a website. We have, again, you should see our fleet of cars. It's pretty cool, actually, over in New Rochelle, down on near Pelham Road. We have a fleet of cars.
Uh-huh.
You want the help? We'll come and get you. We'll take you to that first doctor's appointment. We'll get you there, or that first. You need to sit down. How do I get? I'm hungry. How do I buy food? I'm in a shelter now, but I need whole housing. But I don't have any food. Okay, sit down. We're going to get you food stamps. Again, it's not like a giveaway. It's onerous. You have to know the systems. You have to follow a protocol, or we won't get funding. But what we kind of are, and again, the guy's so good at this because he's done it so long. We're the advocate. We're the guy sitting in there with the doctor. You know, if it's your mom or your brother or your sister or your wife or your kid, saying he takes this drug, but he's allergic to that. He had an infected toe when he was six. He now needs yada, 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 and we help them get it. And we pursue. And look, it's not easy. There are people that are in that first step are in a shelter that we believe is safe, but we're in touch with them. Is it safe? Are you okay? Or we're trying to move them into another one. It's not like we snap our fingers and it happens. But we're there with you. We are advocating for you. We know the system. We know how it works. And frankly, and this is weird. It was weird when I got there, Hesse. The means are there. In some ways, I'm sure that there are people from a political point of view or would not be as happy that they're there. But they are there. People don't know how to use them. The funds are misused. People use them for the wrong reason. People who don't deserve these benefits get them. You know, I've been saying on the radio since you and I met some 17 years ago, if anyone within the sound of my voice doesn't know a fireman or woman or a cop out on a fake disability, give me a call. So people are using these benefits that don't deserve them. But the real people for whom they were intended, our job is to marry the two. But also be there and like as a crutch or a cast.
Hey, let me
will.
Stop you because we only have about a minute left. So
I know
how
that.
Do people reach out to Choice?
I've been a victim of a good interview. I've done that myself.
I'm sorry about that. So tell us how do people reach out to Choice?
Okay. You can go on. The best way to do it is go on our website, Choice of New York. We're all over. We just put out a new website. Choice of New York and call us. And I'm going to give you the phone number right now. If you are homeless and you don't know where to turn, or you have a mental illness issue.
Can't do the commercial.
We
got 15 seconds. Just give me the phone number.
Okay. Choice. Okay. Got 15 seconds. I got to remember this. Okay, here we are. They can't. No, but go on the website. The phone number is 914. 576-0173. But we encourage you, go to Choice of New York and go there.
Okay.
And
you have
and
to
we
spell
can
it out,
you.
Choice of NY, or is it Choice of New York?
And,
okay,
and Hattie,
I'm not
thank
sure
you
what
very
the answer
much
is.
For giving us a chance to get the word out. I love you.
Take care. Be well.
Take
Stay
care,
well.
Brother.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care, folks. We'll speak to you guys tomorrow. Goodbye.